Radio Jones on iTalk FM.
Delighted to welcome you back to Radio Jones, and on the line from live from Beirut, I believe, still in Beirut, is Patrick Henningsen. Good afternoon, Patrick.
Hi, Pippa. How are you?
Good, and thanks for joining us. Are you still in Beirut at the moment?
Yes, I am.
And what's it like there? And what's it like when you look out the window? Is it sunny? Is it cold?
It's evening right now, and it's very hot. So it was about 32 degrees Celsius today. So incredibly hot.
Oh, we can only look forward to those months coming back to us just around the corner here in Spain. Patrick, what I want to speak to you today about is, first of all, let's take it from the beginning. An article that you wrote about the US and UN supplying Syrian rebels with troops, diverting weapons from Croatia to Syria, illegally, so to speak. But the interesting point is that this has been, schools of thought have been aware of this for some time. But just today, David Cameron and France's President Hollande have taken it upon themselves to head off to Brussels and actually hijack essentially a summit which was designed to step up efforts to boost jobs and growth around the European economy, but actually have hijacked that summit in a bid to press the EU to lift an arms embargo against Syria and unblock military aid to rebels on the second anniversary of the uprising. Now, first of all, I want to ask you a question, Patrick. Where do Cameron and Hollande believe that they have the authority to walk into a summit and change the agenda for their own interests?
Well, I'm going to have to call this as I see it, and it's kind of indicative of the times we're living in right now, whereby heads of state, in this case David Cameron and Hollande, will cover what they're trying to do, Pippa, is to cover their tracks. Obviously, the arms gun running and weapons running via Croatia is in the public now, and they're panicking because this is in breach of international law, which was rightly pointed out by the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov recently at a press conference with William Hague. There's no doubt about it. This is a breach of international law. And, you know, international law does not allow, nor does it permit, the supplying of arms to non-governmental actors, and particularly terrorist groups, in this case in Syria. So what Cameron and Hollande are racing to do is to, you know, create a facade. You know, it's a facade of a legal structure with the EU, you know, whereby criminal activity can rewrite the past and the present to make what is illegal and immoral look acceptable. And, you know, never have we seen such rot in our society take place. And this started from Iraq through to, you know, Afghanistan and Libya and Syria. There's no legal or moral grounds to take out, you know, governments and states, people who have seats in the UN. You know, these are real countries, and they're trying to basically topple the governments and then sell off the pieces to the various players.
Let's go back a minute, Patrick, if we may. From my understanding, the ongoing supply of weapons from Croatia to terrorists in Syria has been US and British backed. Where did the French come into this? Why is François Hollande and David Cameron suddenly this morning holding hands and skipping into the summit best of buddies? Because that's there's something that I don't understand here, and that is why suddenly France is indicated in this, and with it being so recent that France took it upon itself to decide to be the freedom maker in Mali, it all seems multi-sinister.
Well, as you know, France, Syria and Lebanon were colonial assets of France during the French mandate, okay? And this sort of ended after World War II, essentially. So they're, you know, they have a lot of connections with the Levant, and also with Mali as well. Obviously, it's a former French colony.
But this recent channeling of arms from Croatia to Syria was not with collusion of the French, was it?
Well, in fact, it was. France itself was sending, you know, C-130-type cargo planes with aid, quote-unquote aid, into Jordan, the same place where the Croatian weapons were landing, and then they were being, you know, transferred from Jordan into Syria into the hands of this CONFAB, which they call the Syrian opposition, which is really about half a dozen known terrorist organizations and Saudi-backed, Qatari-backed mercenary armies. And France was running shipments there. So France might be panicking because they're in direct violation, more than Britain, who is using proxy like Croatia. France is in direct violation of the arms embargo. I don't believe the contents of those planes were ever audited or checked. So it's a case of you can lie to the public and say, oh, we're sending, you know, cargo planes in, there's blankets and medicine there, when in fact there's more than that. And where is that aid going? Even if it was aid, they're sending supplies to Syrian rebels and jihadists and terrorist groups. So France is panicking. You know, this should be an EU crisis. And because it's been done so covertly and under the radar, and because the mainstream media in Europe is so disinterested in holding any of their governments to task for any of these international crimes, they've been allowed to kind of sail through. And now they're trying to rewrite EU law to protect what they've done in the past.
What do we have any update today as what's been the reaction in the EU to the campaign of by Cameron and Hollande to overturn the treaty?
I don't have any sort of documented reactions to it, but you know, clearly the problem with this issue is Syria is a lot of people, including people in politics, are uninformed, and a lot of them get their information from mainstream news sources like the BBC, for instance, which is not reporting anything untoward happening in Syria, obviously, nor is Al Jazeera, who is a Qatari media outlet who's working directly with the U.S. on this operation. So you're not going to see, it's very, very difficult because people just don't know what's going on, and they don't know quite how to challenge this sort of covert activity when it's being done on so many fronts. The other problem here, Pippa, is that Croatia, Britain, France are all NATO countries. So NATO already had a clear agenda in Libya, which they managed to convince the UN to put a no-fly zone in when they destroyed the country after that, bombed it into, you know, 3 decades ago. They've done, NATO is active in this operation in Syria, although it's being done through proxies and under the radar. In the case of Croatia, it's a direct NATO operation. So where is the outrage? You know, where is Stop the War Coalition? Where are our MEPs? You know, where is Nigel Farage? No one's calling this out. It's unbelievable. And they might be a case of they'll be able to rewrite the EU law, lift the arms embargo. And when they do that, Pippa, that means when that embargo is lifted, that means Russia can then supply arms to Bashar al-Assad's government.
But it already has been. Is that not correct?
Well, no. Some of their shipments have been halted. They've been stopped because of the EU arms embargo and because of sanctions against Syria. So it could be a free-for-all if they lift this arms embargo. And you have the makings of a major war.
Well, I mean, you know, the cynical amongst us would perhaps believe that that's exactly what some of these superpowers have wanted in the Middle East, and certainly it looks as though that's what it's heading towards. But it's a heartbreaking situation, Patrick, because yes, the breakup of the Middle East and the bloodshed in the Middle East has been instigated by the illegal wars that have been carried out by governments in the Middle East, and by the fact that countries in the Middle East have been torn apart by one side being supported by the West and the other, and being pitched against each other. But the fact is that there are, for example, in Syria, there are genuinely young educated, intelligent people who have access to the same media that we have access to, who do want a regime change. And those people, some of those people will genuinely be fighting for a regime change. So on the one hand, we have the rebels, in inverted commas, who are potentially going to be backed by countries such as France and the UK. But then you have genuinely people in that country who want to change the regime and who are prepared to lay down their lives for a better Syria. But that's never going to happen for them.
Well, very few people, as opposed to what has been reported, this whole idea of the Arab Spring, a lot of the initial Arab Springs, particularly in Tunisia and Egypt, was seeded, funded, and organized from outside of those countries by major NGOs, and a lot of them being funded by New York-based financial conglomerates like the Open Society Institute, the National Endowment for Democracy, directly state U.S. State Department-funded Arab Spring oppositions. Okay, there's the whole idea of a Syrian opposition. Yes, there is a Syrian opposition. There are people who want reform, but these are people who want stability first. If you live in any country, you don't want to see your country tossed and turned and, 100,000 people slaughtered in order to get your regime change. It doesn't make any sense. So a lot of this is propaganda that we've been fed in the West.
But those people who want reform, but they want stability first, with a leader like Bashar al-Assad in power, how's that ever going to happen? How would a regime be able to be changed with stability first when you have a leader like him in power?
Well, you say a leader like him as if he's a known war criminal. He's not. What is the actual... They put numbers up that are amazing. They say 60,000, 70,000 people have been... Civilians have been killed. No one can verify any of these numbers. But what has been verified is the majority of foreign fighters who've taken up arms in Syria, who call themselves opposition, the majority, more than a comfortable majority, are from outside of Syria. So if you're in Marbella, Spain, this would be the equivalent of during the Spanish Spring that fighters from Morocco would be coming up, setting up camp in southern Spain, demanding a regime change in Madrid, and backed by the U.S., Britain, and France to do so. It's unacceptable for the Spanish people. And you shouldn't think it's any different in Syria. Reform would come eventually, but the other thing is, Syria has been at war with Israel, or at least there's been an armistice since 1974, but, already you can see what's going to happen is that they'll lose the Golan Heights, which is a major source of water, agriculture, and oil, and that's going to go to Israel if Syria is destabilized. That's already happening right now. So there is that is the pretext or the context in which, the Ba'athist Assad family has ruled because it's been a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week security state because of the warring factions around Syria. And I'm sure that the moderates would prevail in that country if there wasn't so much pressure put to bear on it from outside of the country.
What?
And that's a pattern you see all over the region.
What do you think from this point now? Obviously, it is a point of no return. Something has to be done. What do you feel? Where should we go forward from here in Syria in terms of the international community?
Well, the first thing is the international community should call international war crimes international war crimes and stop ignoring it. That you can't do this. If you allow NATO and allies to do this again to Syria, which they've already done in Libya, then it's a free-for-all. They can do it anywhere they want at any time. They can reform a country at will. It's a bit like a mafia, international mafia. They say, I'm coming to get you, and there's nothing you can do about it. What kind of societies are we actually living in here? And we're having all these austerity cuts at home, yet they have 80 million for, al-Qaeda-related groups in Syria on hand just to throw them money, hundreds of millions of pounds. So it's absolutely ridiculous on its face, but the reality is this: the dominant groups in Syria on the opposition front, the foreign fighters, one of them is the al-Nusra Front. This is directly linked to Saudi intelligence. They've already established Sharia law in the towns. this is an extremist version of Islam that was not allowed under the Assad government, which has a separation of church and state. It's the same system that we have in Europe and America. So that is going out the door as soon as this government falls, if the West has its way. So it's going to be more of a Wahhabist, extremist, balkanized country, whereby, you know, you talk about women's rights and everything like that is gone. It's finished. So why are they backing? Why is the West backing these extremist, Wahhabist, Saudi-backed groups as well? That's a question that the international community needs to ask right now, because it's very close, to going the wrong way. And most Muslims, if you poll them, 95% would not like to live in Saudi Arabia. And the reason is because they do prefer to live in a normal country, not a theocracy. Most people do. But that theocracy is the Saudi and the Qataris want to divide Syria up into a new emirate. It's kind of a theocratic emirate. And I don't know what their plan is as far as dividing the country, but it will be chopped up into numerous pieces and divided along ethnic and religious lines. And of course, below that, you have the economic spoils in the different parts of Syria, and those will be divided up through corporations. That's what this is all about. That's what it's always been about. It's not about pro-democracy reform.
The Russians have been backing Assad, and in fact were in the last couple of years have sold nearly over $1 billion worth of arms to Assad, including missile systems. They're part of the international community. What is their take on what's happening there? If they believe that they're justified in sending those type of weapons to Assad, what is their remit in Syria?
Well, their remit is Syria doesn't produce arms. Syria is a trading partner. Syria has to protect its borders, and Syria doesn't have the sort of record of invading and occupying countries. Although you can argue that it did have a kind of an occupation of Lebanon for a while, but that's because Lebanon didn't have a standing army, and it was using Syria's army as its army. And of course, Israel was fighting Syria on Lebanese territory. It's more complicated than that, the Lebanese civil war. But Israel purchases per year in excess of $4 billion U.S. military hardware, and that pales in comparison to what Russia and Syria trade. So they're a trading partner, okay, and Syria needs defense, and it gets some of it from Russia. Now, look at the clients of Britain, selling arms right across the Gulf, BAE Systems and all the other contractors. David Cameron even goes to sign close the deals himself in the Emirates, in Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain. They're highly militarizing the Gulf, Britain and the U.S., like we've never seen before. And, so to point out Russia and Syria's, arms trade it pales in comparison to what's going on around Syria. If you were in Syria and looking at what's going on around you, you'd be a little bit worried. So you'd want to have at least the bare minimum to protect yourself.
Three Russian warships docked in Beirut port on Thursday, yesterday, as I understand, reported on Al Mayadeen television, and have said that they'll stay in Lebanese waters for 3 days before departing to Syria. Now, you're there in Beirut. What do you know of this?
I saw that report. I mean, Russia has traditionally a major port in Tartus, which is just up the coast from northern Lebanon. So I would say that this is, naval positioning isn't super important in today's world, which is really ruled by air power. And even the U.S.'s 5th Naval Fleet, which is stationed in Bahrain, should a conflict with Iran take place, those ships are about as useful as museum pieces when it comes to conflict, because that conflict will be determined in the air. And most major conflicts have been for the last, since before World War II. But certainly it's very worrying, because what you have is potentially that this you know, destabilization project in Syria could spill over into Lebanon, and that would make this a regional war. And of course, then the UN might put a resolution in, and if they do, then you have the potential for an all-out war in the Middle East, and that is on the doorstep of a third world war. This is the fire that David Cameron and Hollande and Obama are playing with. And I think it's a very dangerous situation.
And what of today, as we know, the meeting being hijacked by Hollande and Cameron to get their message across, if that embargo is overturned, when do we have a time frame for that?
It's difficult to say. I don't know the ins and outs of EU legalese, but again, it's really important that look at the timing of them hijacking a meeting that had nothing to do with what they were posing on the table. Why are they in such a rush to do that? I'll tell you why, because if what they've done with Croatia that's now public, if that's allowed to fester in the media or in political circles, then, you know, opposition parties like Labour might get interested. You know, they might say, wow, we can just dump the Tory government right here now. And, opponents of France and Britain can seize on this. Croatia should lose its EU membership, which is not a full member yet. It's due to be next year. They should be kicked out of the EU for what they've done. I mean, if you look at Europe and what it's supposed to stand for, you know, what it claims it's supposed to stand for, which is stability and peace, the European Commission was given the Nobel Peace Prize only last February.
Correct.
I mean, what do they really stand for? And here you have Croatia on the doorstep of EU membership, running 75 planes with 3,000 tons of heavy weaponry into Jordan secretly, which is handled then by British and American troops who are training the fighters, foreign fighters, many of them, and then off they go into Syria to create mayhem. I mean, how does this look on the international map? It looks, it's a diabolical, chaotic situation.
But to play devil's advocate, if Assad's side is fully armed and the Syrian rebels, albeit wherever they come from, whether they come from outside of Syria or inside Syria, are not armed, then we're left, we're in danger of repeating what happened with the Bosnian Muslims, who were left at the hands of the Serbs because they weren't armed to the capabilities that the Serbs were, and the West didn't want to help them. So is perhaps playing devil's advocate, is this not actually a step to prevent that kind of extremity happening?
Well, there's a big difference between Bosnians who live in Bosnia and who were born there and, you know, been there for hundreds of thousands of years, and people from Chechnya, from Iraq, from Jordan, from Tunisia, from Egypt, from Afghanistan, being shipped in through Turkey to fight someone else's war and being paid salaries of $500 per month and up to sort of the highest middle officers, $3,000 a month.
And where are those figures from, Patrick?
This is from eyewitness, first-hand accounts on the ground in Syria. You can look up some of this stuff online. I haven't cited these specific figures, but they're being paid. There is a genuine Sunni jihadist element, especially between 18 to 25-year-olds, with regards to taking up this God's sort of cause to fight Bashar al-Assad on behalf of al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. But the real proper mercenaries are being paid. And where is the money coming from? It's already been revealed where a lot of the money is coming from. It's coming from Saudi Arabia and Qatar. You're actually writing the checks, sending the cash, because the U.S. and Britain can't do that directly for obvious reasons.
Absolutely.
But the Bosnian situation, Zbigniew Brzezinski and some of the top people who had made the Mujahideen in Afghanistan repatriated many of those foreign fighters into Bosnia. So there were, believe it or not, there was, and this is on record history, there were Afghans and other Muslims fighting, Saudis, Egyptians, Algerians fighting in Bosnia during that time. So our knowledge of Bosnia is also maybe not so accurate in terms of maybe what the BBC's version is or, you know, U.S. News World Report's version is. But if you research the Yugoslavian war closely, you can see that not all is what it seemed as far as the narrative that we were given at the end, which was the evil Slobodan Milosevic versus the Croatians and the Bosnians. It was a lot more going on than that. In fact, it has a lot of similarities to what's going on right now in Syria.
Which I suppose we shouldn't be surprised at all about that. But what's important is to have journalists like you working to uncover the truth. Patrick, we're going to have to leave it there. I promise I'll only take 10 minutes of your time. I've taken a lot longer. But that's
happy to talk with you. It's a very important subject, and we need to know what's going on in this part of the world for sure.
Absolutely. It's an absolute pleasure. Patrick Henningsen, who's live from Beirut, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Jones.
Thanks, Pippa.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.